On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Ever since the War on Terror began after September 11, we have been, in one way or another, with one group of warriors or another, involved in war. And we might call it the War on Terror, we might call it military action, but what it means is that people have traveled to other places to engage with people that we have considered the enemy. What does that mean for us as a nation? What does it mean for us to be caught in perpetual warfare? And even if there's not a declared war going on, what is going on with our military? And even deeper issues are the ones that we're going to be talking about today. In other words, how much does it remove us as citizens and as human beings from destruction if we use drones? Can we pretend that destruction isn't going on? Can we pretend that people who are civilians are being killed? Well, here to discuss those issues is Norman Solomon. He is co-founder of RootsAction.org and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. His books include War Made Easy and Made Love Got War. His latest book is War Made Invisible: How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. It's from The New Press, and you can check their website, thenewpress.com. And available in bookstores and online everywhere. Norman, thank you very much for giving us a chance to address some of these questions that we often do not ask, but they need to be asked. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.
How did you first start preparing this? Was it when you wrote War Made Easy? I mean, did you start doing research that would become War Made Invisible? Or are we talking about really completely different sort of set of circumstances or a different set of concerns?
I'd say it's a set of intensified circumstances that have been with us for many decades. I am 72 years old, so as a teenager, I watched the escalation through political language and news media of the Vietnam War. And it's been fascinating to me, and I think it's very important, that the particular ideology, whether somebody is a Democrat or a Republican, a liberal or a conservative, however that is self-described, that can change over the decades in terms of attitudes towards war. And my view is that whatever our political affiliation or party identification is, we need a consistent moral standard. We need, if you will, an ethical or a spiritual approach that doesn't blow with the wind, that doesn't say, oh, that guy in the White House, it's a Democrat, so that's okay. Or that guy in the White House, it's a Republican, that's okay. No, we need to have, and it's a challenge for us, to not be blown around by, I can't say just the winds, sometimes the hurricanes of the political rhetoric, and sometimes one might say the propaganda, to instead of going with that particular pressure, to say, we have to have a single standard. And that's what really drew me to writing this book, War Made Invisible, because, as you allude to, so much of what goes on in our names, with our tax dollars, far away, is so isolated from us, and vice versa, that we barely have a clue about what's going on. And unless we as people, as citizens, however we want to describe ourselves, unless we really pay attention and we think about our own possibilities and responsibilities, then we're being manipulated. And that's not what democracy should be about.
It's interesting that you brought up your age, because I'm 70. And I can remember being a paper boy and reading the headlines of the morning before I threw the papers and following the war in Vietnam. And there is a certain level of this Vietnamization kind of concept, what they used to call the Vietnam syndrome, which was, we got into a war, how do we finish it? I was reminded in reading your book about a book I read about a year ago that talked about the policies that were developed prior to World War II for an offensive using aircraft. And they came up with the idea of the the Norden bomb site and all, with the specific idea of this will make sure that we're not killing a lot of civilians, that we're dropping the bombs on the factories, and therefore we will not be killing civilians because we don't want it to be the bloodbath that World War I was. So we'll be much more careful. And that was a noble goal. But they found out that it didn't work out very well in real time because of a couple of factors. One is that the people we were trying to bomb were shooting back at us. That makes it pretty dangerous and makes you want to get in and out in a hurry. If there's cloud cover, the bomb sites were not particularly effective. And we found out that we were dropping a lot of bombs and we really weren't blowing up a lot of factories, but there was a lot of collateral damage. And therefore, they decided, well, if we're going to have collateral damage anyway, let's do it upright. And that's when we started firebombing. And that's what happened to Dresden and other places. And then we moved that over to Japan and firebombed Tokyo so that more people actually died in the firebombing attacks than died in the two nuclear attacks, because it just burned an entire city to cinders. That I was reminded of that when I read your book, because it made me think, I can remember in Desert Storm, we watched it on TV. Oh, those smart bombs. Oh, well, this makes us feel better because we're not just blowing up everything. We're just blowing up the bad guys. That's a lovely illusion, but reality of it is there are plenty of times that even smart bombs and smart missiles don't always get just the bad guys. There's often a considerable amount of damage to the people that are in the vicinity of the bad guys, right?
It is a comforting illusion, and it's constantly, through omission and commission, reinforced by our news media. Left, right, or center news media in this country, you can watch Fox, CNN, MSNBC, and they don't talk about the suffering that the United States bombing and warfare is causing among civilians. We're not talking about a few civilians. Brown University did a study and found that since 9/11, the post-9/11 wars led by the United States has resulted in more than 300,000 direct killings of civilians and several times as many indirect, from the cascading effects, destruction of infrastructure, healthcare, housing, and so forth. So these ideas are very useful to those who are profiting from these wars. They've been called Beltway bandits, but these big military contractors. And it frankly doesn't have anything to do with defense of the United States. We have something called the Defense Department. You can call it anything you want, uppercase D. But when it comes to defending the United States, that's pretty mythological. And I make a case in the book, whether it was Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, that didn't have to do with defending the United States. It had to do with the rhetoric coming from Democrats and Republicans in Washington. It had to do with beefing up the tremendous profits being made by companies like Northrop Grumman and Boeing and Raytheon, making literally billions of dollars of profits every year. And so there's enormous pressure and there's enormous euphemisms being used to cushion us, to give us a cloud of illusion to think, well, people got in the wrong space. Yes, it's too bad. We don't mean to kill them. So we're okay. Our hands are clean. Well, I give an analogy. If there was a police force, whether in New York City, San Francisco, Montgomery, wherever, and they said, well, we've got to get these bad guys. We've got to get the criminals. So we know there's some out there. We have some ideas of where they are. So we're going to go up and down the shopping district streets, and we're going to fire our machine guns into the storefronts because we know they're in there. We got some information. We got some intelligence. And predictably, many shoppers and others who were completely innocent would be killed. Well, the police force could say, just as the Pentagon says, well, we weren't targeting civilians. That was an accident. It was really, I'm sorry, that's too bad, but that's the way it goes. That's warfare. That's law enforcement. How would that go down in New York or San Francisco or Montgomery? We would be outraged. We wouldn't put up with it. And yet there are people in Iraq and Afghanistan who are mourning their loved ones, not just a few, not just a few hundred, but many, many thousands, even hundreds of thousands of people who lost their lives exactly from that kind of Pentagon attitude. And so people might say, well, look, I'm a patriot. I served in the military and or my relatives did. I love America. I love the flag. I met a woman, a young girl at that point, she's now a woman, in Afghanistan on a reporting trip. And she was 7 years old in Helmand province. She woke up one morning and the bomb had fallen on her house and she lost an arm. So I met this girl at that point. She had one arm. Why did she have one arm? Because the United States had dropped bombs on her neighborhood. Well, she didn't care if the president who ordered that kind of military action was a Democrat or Republican. She didn't care if it wasn't intentional, quote unquote. It was certainly predictable. And so we have a challenge, whether we're Christian, Jewish, Muslim, whatever. We have a challenge to say, what does our faith tell us? What does our spirituality mean for us in terms of other human beings? And unfortunately, we all too often are encouraged successfully to believe that Old Glory covers these sins, that it's okay, that if the United States government does it because the USA is such a wonderful country, that it's not a big problem. And I wrote this book to say it is a big problem.
We're talking, if you're just joining us, to Norman Solomon, the author of War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. It's from The New Press, and you can check their website, thenewpress.com. One of the things that you point out in the book is that cluster bombs have been used not just on concrete hardened bunkers where the bad guys are waiting to kill us, but that they also have been used in what we would call soft targets, and is horrendously destructive. The U.S. media went after Russia when they used cluster bombs on Ukraine, but you talk in the book about we've used them too, or we've sold them to people who use them. That's a pretty terrible thing to realize. That's never particularly mentioned. As you point out, it doesn't really seem to matter which media it is. Nobody talks much about the possibility that we're not as careful about selling weapons to the good guys as we should be, or there are certain weapons that are so horrific that they should not be used that aren't even nuclear.
It is important to realize and to come to terms with it, I think. As you mentioned, cluster munitions, and they're called munitions because they can be in the form of bombs dropped from on high or fired as mortars or whatever. Cluster munitions are among the very worst, the most horrible weapons in existence in terms of warfare. And quite properly, when the Russians attacked Ukraine, invaded about 18 months ago, U.S. news media and the White House and Democrats and Republicans in Congress denounced it as use of a terrible, inhumane weapon. And what happened in the last year and a half, and I write about the media condemnation of Russia's use in my book, but since that time, gradually the United States and NATO countries were running out of weaponry to supply to the Ukrainian military. And what became at first unthinkable then became thinkable. And so the reality is that the United States has had huge quantities of cluster munitions stockpiled. It's not that we haven't used them. We used so many in the invasion of Iraq in 2003 in the first few weeks that the Congressional Study Office provided data saying, and I cite this in the book, 1.8 million to 2 million what are called bomblets, which is sort of a container of shrapnel from the cluster munitions were used just in those first few weeks of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And so the U.S. has used them in the past, just as Russia has been using them. And in the last little while, when the U.S. was running out of other kinds of weaponry, then the fact that the U.S. has so many of these cluster munitions stockpiled began to cry out for usage. And it was a rationale, and again, this was bipartisan, Democrats and Republicans in Congress. They said, oh, well, we really need these weapons. We need to use them. We're running out. And the conclusion, the pressure came from the bipartisan powers in Congress on President Biden. And so a few weeks ago, President Biden did a 180, and he announced that the U.S. would be shipping really massive quantities of cluster munitions to the Ukrainian military for use. And so as we speak, civilians are having their bodies shredded by this shrapnel from these cluster munitions. And I think it's an example of how there is mission creep. And it turns into, as I say, a mission dash. Really, a lot behind it is the dash for cash, the desire of people running these huge corporations to maximize their profit margin. We have, though, if we are going to truly live in a democracy, I think have an opportunity to say, we take seriously what we were taught in civics class. We believe that democracy, a republic, requires the informed consent of the governed. And informed is the key word there. If we're not informed, then our consent is not really meaningful.
It reminds me that 63 years or so ago, an outgoing president who was a former five-star general, commander-in-chief of the Normandy invasion and the Allied invasion of Sicily and Italy, Dwight Eisenhower, warned of the military-industrial complex. I begin to realize what that military-industrial complex is all about. And certainly, in your book, this is as good a way of saying it as anything, that the idea that we've got these weapons, we want to sell them, and whether we sell them to the United States government or to other governments that are our allies, a cluster bomb, for example, is just a giant shotgun shell.
We absolutely are in a situation where we are, by omission as well as commission, being lied to. That's the blunt way to say it. I can watch CNN, I can watch Fox, I can watch Newsmax, I can watch MSNBC. None of them are going to be honest with me about what is being used for my tax dollars to provide weaponry around the world. The United States, by the way, is the largest single seller of weaponry for export on the planet. And the realities, as we've been talking about, of the warfare that we're encouraged to simply applaud, those are human realities. And whatever outlook we might have on other countries, if we have sort of the basics, these are not Martians. They're not from Pluto or Venus. They're other human beings. They had no more or less say over what country they were born in than we do. And I think it's a very crucial, it's sort of a gut check, you might say. It's also an opportunity because we get blown a lot of smoke by powerful people in Washington. And if we're going to get to a different place, I think we need to make a lot of these basic connections. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. talked about what he called the demonic suction tube of these excessive expenditures for the military. This was during the Vietnam War, and tremendous amounts of money, of course, being spent on the military then as now. And he called it a demonic suction tube because of where the resources went to kill, but also where they were deprived, where the deprivation took place. And that would be here at home. So just as in 1967, when he made that statement, Dr. King was foreshadowing what he called the madness of militarism in the present day. And so whether you live in New York, California, Alabama, or anywhere else, it's not hard to find places in communities where there's a basic lack of health care, education, housing, infant care, elderly care. These are possibilities that are being unmet. This isn't necessary. This is still the richest country in the world, but people are being ripped off. And one of the ways we're being ripped off is the money is going to subsidize basically these huge profits of the military contractors, what Eisenhower did refer to as the military-industrial complex, and their gain is our loss.
One of the things that you talk about in your book, and we could talk for a very long time, but we only have 30 minutes, so I want to make sure we get at least one or two more points made, is that the United States was not happy with the way we pulled out of Afghanistan because we were leaving an awful lot of allies to the mercy of the Taliban, but also the destruction that had been wrought in the country was leading to the food supply and so forth being severely affected. Reading here, during the first months of 2022, the situation worsened in Afghanistan. Severe malnutrition was widespread. Human Rights Watch cited an estimate that upwards of 13,000 newborn babies in the country, one in 10, had died since January. I don't remember hearing anything about that on any news media. If we had, would we have been upset enough to say, well, let's just send them some food or send them some money so they can get food? Or would we just say, well, you know, it's on the Taliban now. They should take care of their own people. That's one of the points that sticks after reading your book. The second was that we're largely indifferent to the mental and emotional wounds of our soldiers, our sailors, our Marines, our Air Force, our special ops guys who have come back from wartime. And you point out also contractors, if they get killed or wounded, we never hear about that. Even though many of them are former military, it's because they're private contractors, their casualty rates are not reported by the military.
Oh, yes, that's absolutely correct. And that's one reason the Pentagon brass like it, because when they have to announce how many people in the military have been killed, as you referred to, that doesn't include the contractors who've done major work, dangerous work in the Middle East and Afghanistan and elsewhere. This is such a eye-opening reality, and it was stunning to me working on this book to realize that the people running our wars, in the White House, in the Congress, and really the people at the top of the Pentagon chain are working for them, the hypocrisy is so extreme. We heard for so many years that the United States was fighting in Afghanistan to benefit the people of Afghanistan. And yet, as you refer to, when the U.S. finally pulled out of that country after the longest war in U.S. history, there was huge indifference to the fate of people there in terms of starvation. And the United States had $7 billion with a B dollars of the Afghan government money, did not give it back. And so the central bank was decimated in Afghanistan, and people starved through the winter after we disappeared. Many lost their lives. So which is it? Are we there to help other people as well as ourselves? Are we just there to help ourselves? Are we moving ourselves, our pieces along the global chessboard? I fear it's the latter. And I think if we're going to have a government that is as good as our best moral goals, then we have to have a quantum shift in attitudes. And I think it was Will Rogers or Mark Twain, I've heard both the attribution there, said, it's not what people don't know that bothers me. It's what they don't know and what they just don't know. In other words, the way it went is, it's not what people don't know that bothers me, it's what they know that just ain't so. And what we know that just ain't so is the most dangerous. And so we have been brought up, and the news media tell us, that the United States enters into wars only for the most noble of reasons. That's something we know. It just isn't true.
That another thing that you discovered and that you report about in the book is that if you're a woman in the military, it's extremely hazardous. This is not really a huge surprise to those of us who are not thrilled with the idea of sending women into combat zones. And all of that was poo-pooed as, oh, of course it'll be safe. It'll be swell. It'll be great. And in the movies, everybody always gets along. But in real life, it can be really dangerous to be a woman in the military. And I appreciate the fact that you bring that out in your book.
In the real world, it also can be really dangerous to be married to a man in the military.
Yeah.
And the data are really clear that so many men are suffering from PTSD. They're thrown into warfare, into training. They're taught to kill. They suffer from what 100 years ago was called shell shock. Now we call it PTSD. And then the U.S. government says, okay, we're done with you. Go home. And the rates of domestic violence inflicted on women by their partners who were in the military, of course, most veterans don't engage in domestic violence. But the rate of domestic violence among veterans, especially combat veterans, is extremely high, and women suffer as a result.
I'd like to close our time together with a quote. Without a single standard of human rights and empathy for the victims of war, we lose human connection with them and with ourselves. I think that might be the very best way to look at this concept of war made invisible. I think to me that's the most important thing in the book. The other stuff is certainly important, but the reminder that pretending that civilians do not get much of a choice about whether or not they become collateral damage, this should be something that we, as a people who consider ourselves compassionate, this needs to be something that we consider very, very serious and hold our elected officials, whatever party they belong to, accountable to that.
I fully agree. I think you said it very well. This is not only about what happens to other people. This is also about us.
And Dr. Martin Luther King said that racism and slavery is just as damaging to the oppressor as it is to the oppressed, because it steals their humanity. If we can be callous about casualties, then it's not good for us either.
Absolutely. That's such a key point.
Norman, is there anything that you wanted me to ask you about that I didn't?
Well, I think you raised some key questions and brought some insights that are really important to our discussion. I want to encourage people, of course, whether at the library or some other way, to obtain this book, War Made Invisible, and also to consider how we can get beyond this polarization between the two political parties in this context. It's good to have debate, nonviolent discourse, respectful disagreements. At the same time, these are issues that we've been discussing for the last half hour that aren't about whether we're Democrats or Republicans. It's about what it means to be a human.
Hmm. Absolutely. Our guest today has been Norman Solomon. His new book, War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. It's from The New Press. You can check their website, thenewpress.com. Certainly, you can go to your favorite bookstore or online. Norman, do you have a website that people could access as well?
Sure. People can go to the website, which is warmadeinvisible.com. That's just the name of the book, .com. And there's a lot of information and articles up there as well.
WarMadeInvisible.com. Norman Solomon, thank you very much for the opportunity to read your book and the opportunity to talk to you about these very important issues. I appreciate very much your taking the time to be with us today on the bookshelf.
Oh, thanks a lot. I really appreciate the chance to talk with you and to your audience.
Our thanks again to Norman Solomon, the author of War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and on your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.